Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am one of your hosts for today, Ursula Rudenberg, together with my co-hosts, Rebecca Brown and James Winter.
Hi.
Hello.
So, James. James is a fairly new KHOI volunteer, and this is the first time you are sitting in with us as a reporter, James. Welcome to Local Talk.
Thank you.
Describe a little bit what you've been doing here at KHOI.
Well, the wind sort of blew me in, and ever since then, I've just been producing promotional spots and assisting some of the other contributors with the production of their shows. And in other words, I'm sitting in front of a computer and looking at graphical representations of sound and putting music behind it and, you know, making it juicy. I've also dropped in a little voice talent as well whenever needed.
Well, you've been very helpful to the station, and
we
really all appreciate what you're doing. Would you start us out with a weather report?
I'd be honored. Today there's a chance of rain and snow. I'd say a very good chance, looking out the window, mainly before noon. It'll be cloudy with a high near 41. Also be pretty windy from the north with gusts as high as 43 miles per hour. Like I said, snow is possible. Tonight's mostly clear with a low around 27. It will continue to be windy. Saturday is expected to become sunny with a high near 54, but at night it will get cloudy with a 20% chance of precipitation. It is April, after all, and the low is expected to be around 39 degrees on Saturday night.
We want to take a minute, too, to note the phenology calendar, which tracks events in the natural world. It says that this week is when the mourning doves are scheduled to lay their egg, and we wanted to take a moment for this lovely animal, especially since the call of the mourning dove is one of the small but really beautiful things that make up life in Iowa. You may very much like me associate the mourning dove's cooing with my very first childhood memories of spring and sun and early morning. So when I told KHOI reporter Susan Franson that I was planning to play the mourning dove call this morning, she told me that she holds fond memories of a particular dove. And so I recorded her story about that dove. And while we enjoy the sound of the mourning dove together, let's hear Susan's mourning dove story.
There's one special bird that I really love, and that's the mourning dove. And whenever I see them, I think about the year that the mourning dove made a nest in the maple tree, I don't think more than 12 feet from the edge of our deck. Now, this was very close, and it's not a very comfortable place to build a nest. One of these, it's a silver maple, and it has two fairly large branches that just go directly off the trunk, so there's a sharp V between these two. It's low to the ground, eye level off the deck. She was really, really close. I mean, you can certainly see her, but she must have thought we couldn't. We eat our lunches out on the deck, lunch and supper, if the weather's right. So every lunchtime, I'd look over and see her. I mean, you couldn't not see her, and she couldn't avoid seeing us. So I don't know what she was thinking of us. And this bird sat there. She sat like a little statue. And she sat there, and she sat there. We had some major work done that year. Some construction work on our house, which was not more than 15 feet from this nest. We were painting, moving around, workmen were coming, and this bird just sat there and sat there. And she sat there and she sat there and sat there. With all this activity going on, like, this is my place and I'll put up with it. Gotta hatch the eggs. I never saw a nest. I don't know, she may have just laid it in that crotch of the tree, and I couldn't understand why she chose it, but once she had, she certainly was devoted. I understand that the mourning doves mate for life, and they trade off their tending of the nest, so maybe he sat there some of the time, but I never saw the trade-off. Finally, she went away, and I never really saw the nest or the chick. I think it didn't survive this very inhospitable nesting place. I guess they have one or two. Hopefully she only had one in that teeny tiny place until she gave up. So it's nice to know that mourning doves have several nests during the year, so maybe the next time she found a better place. But I certainly remember her fondly. I felt great admiration for her and awe almost at the devotion of this really fruitless task. But it took weeks. They were so persistent. It was a long, long time, and I got really attached to the mourning dove, partly because I felt so sorry for her. After that, she never came back.
You are listening to Local Talk, where we explore the people, stories, and events in central Iowa. And that was the mourning dove, which is scheduled to start laying eggs this week. We have two major stories today for the last part of our program. Chris and Tammy Martin will be coming in to tell us about their 2 years in Peace Corps in Ghana.
But first, we're going to talk about wind. Not just about how windy it is these days, but how wind is serving us. This will be the first in what may become a number of program segments dedicated to exploring the use of wind energy in Iowa. We'll look at it on a small scale by visiting with a family farm that powers its operations from a single wind turbine. And then we'll look at a large-scale wind farms and electrical power to Ames Utilities.
First, though, we'll look at how the turbine at Iowa State University supplies power and education opportunities. Randy Larrabee is here in the studio.
Thank you. I'm here.
Randy is the Assistant Director of Utilities at Iowa State University, and the man in the news as ISU's wind turbine celebrates its first year in operation. So welcome, and thank you for coming down.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Randy, why did Iowa State build a wind turbine?
We were wanting to get a presence of wind on campus. You mentioned that you're going to be exploring the large side of the wind farm, too, and we participate also in that aspect, too, and get part of our energy from the NextEra wind farm that is, you know, out here in northeast Story County. But we wanted to have a wind turbine on campus that would show, you know, that could be used to show we were doing something locally, to show that we were interested in promoting wind and basically give the opportunity to use it for an educational tool also. And that's really what I'm working on right now is promoting the educational side of this thing. So
when did you build the wind turbine?
The wind turbine went online late December of 2012. It showed up on December 18th, was assembled, put together, connected to the grid in basically 48 hours, and then was running on December 19th of 2012.
So you make it sound like a kit.
Well, it really was. I mean, there was a lot of work that went in ahead of that. You know, we had to do the foundation for it. We had to get the electrical service extended to it so it could connect into our system. But in reality, yeah, it showed up on two semis with a big crane, and it's physically went together in a little more than 48 hours. So it is
wow.
Basically a big kit. I mean, we have a video on our utilities website that we videotaped the entire installation over the 2 days, and it's been compressed down to about a 7-minute video, and it shows the complete install of it. And it's a very neat process to watch them go up. So
these teams of guys are really all over the country right now putting these together, so this has kind of become, they've made short work of this. Huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, this crew that came in, this is all they do, is they show up with the, when the semis show up with the equipment itself, and it was like they were on an assembly line in a well-oiled machine. They anticipated the next piece immediately, what was going on. There was no wasted time in the install of this machine.
Is this an expensive project?
This wind turbine is actually, Iowa State does not own it. What we did is we leased a piece of Iowa State property to this particular vendor. So they assembled it themselves. Estimated cost of the entire wind turbine is probably around $700,000. Iowa State buys all the energy off of it. We signed what we basically call a 10-year purchase power agreement, and we're buying the energy off of it at 10 cents a kilowatt hour, which is a little higher than what you would get off the grid, but for the reasons we wanted it, you know, we were comfortable with that rate. We probably invested, I think, about $300,000 into it, out of state funds to do it. So that was a joint project between ISU Utilities and the ISU Facilities Planning and Management Group out of some funds that we had available to us.
As a lease agreement, then the university is not responsible for, say, the cost of upkeep or any maintenance that may be required for the equipment. Is that, would that be the true statement?
That is a true statement. Yes, the vendor that we bought it from is responsible for all of that. The main reason we went that way is because of the tax credits. You know, that's what's driving wind right now is the tax credits. And if we would have outright bought it and put it in ourselves, we could not take advantage of the tax credits. So by going in this route, this vendor can also take advantage of the tax credits.
So describe what the tax credits.
Well, there's what's been driving wind for the last number of years, and is is a federal tax credit, that, and maybe even a state one too. I don't stay involved in all of that. It basically allows them to decrease their property tax on it if it's installed by a certain date. And so when you work that into the overall operation of the machine, then it becomes a lot less expensive to own and operate. So
this is a wind turbine that's easily seen. Can you describe where the turbine can be seen, where it's located on
sure.
campus?
Sure. It actually can be seen from quite a distance away, but it is physically located just south of the intersection of University Boulevard and Syride Drive. So it's just to the west of the Syride facility, or to the north of our cooling tower, or just to the east of the ISU power plant. So, mm-hmm.
Up by the sycamore trees.
Yes. Yep. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can stand out at the Olson Building on South 4th Street, and you can see it over the top of Sheman Building just fine. Or you can be almost glued to the west end of Osborne Drive, and you look down Osborne Drive. That was kind of an accident. You can stand out down at the west end of Osborne Drive and look down the street and see it. I mean, the location was picked for basically three reasons. We had to put it in a spot that met the clearances from everything else. You have to basically allow if it was a structurally collapsed, that it would not fall on another structure. Mm-hmm. So we couldn't put it close to a building. We had to put it in a location that was close to the electrical source, because we didn't want to have to go a quarter mile with underground cables to get to it. And third and lastly is we wanted it in a spot where it could be seen easily. So we wound up in that spot right there. It was a clean spot. It would have been difficult to put it someplace on main campus, because we also could have been under a position that we might have had to move it in 5 years if something else came up that wanted that space that was more important.
Yeah.
I've always been curious. Now, is there like some kind of a weather vane on the top of it that actually determines wind speed and direction, and then adjusts the positioning of it, mm-hmm. and the feathering of the blades? And I wonder if you could briefly describe that.
Sure, sure. This unit, the blades are fixed, so they don't feather. Okay. Now, like the larger machines that are up in the NextEra wind farm, northeast here of Ames, those blades, they can adjust the pitch on the blades, but this machine does not. But, yes, on top of it, there is both a wind direction and a wind speed monitoring equipment. And we have access to that information through the control system, all the time. And basically what it's doing is it automatically then tracks the wind direction. And if the direction of the wind gets a couple of degrees off of what the direction of the wind turbine is pointed, the wind turbine automatically turns itself into the wind direction.
That is automated. Okay.
It's all automated.
That's great. Mm-hmm.
So it's constantly seeking the wind.
It's constantly seeking the wind. That's right. Yes, mm-hmm. It is.
So is it a smaller one then, and that's why it doesn't require the feathering? Because I do see the large ones, mm-hmm. and I wondered about that. And if in a really gusty conditions, those blades, probably the root of those blades might not be able to tolerate the tensile strength, under high wind, so they have to mm-hmm. feather them and right. back off a little bit. But
right.
this is a smaller one, is that
right,
what you're saying?
Right. This is just a 100-kilowatt machine. So whereas the ones up here in the wind farm to the north are basically a 1.5 megawatt or 1,500 kilowatts. So this is 1/15 the size of one of those big machines up there. So, but it's also at a different height. This one is at about 120 feet, whereas the big wind turbines are around 250 feet to the center of the hub.
So we're speaking with Randy Larrabee, who is the assistant director of the utilities at Iowa State University, and apparently the man pretty much in charge of the wind turbine. Can you describe to us, what do you do with the wind turbine?
Well, the wind turbine is connected to our electrical system, and we use all the energy right there on campus. So, and this last year, it generated essentially the equivalent energy of a couple of our buildings on campus. By coincidence, it happened to generate essentially the same energy that the president's house used on electricity. So, which was very close to it.
So are you saying he got all the wind energy?
He could claim it if he wants to, but I can't say exactly where the energy went on campus, because it goes into our system. It's very possible mm-hmm. that with where it's physically connected, the power plant used all the energy, and because it's behind the power plant.
But so you use it to supplement?
We use it to supplement our generation on campus, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely.
What's the educational aspect then for students involved with the presence of the turbine there?
Presence of the turbine. We, as part of this package, Iowa State is working with the manufacturer who offers a program, what they call Wind for Schools. And basically that is a web-based program that we can provide them a web-based or website that they can access that's password protected. They can log on to it. Up to 50 people can be on it at any time. So and that gives them the exact same information on the wind turbine that I can see at the control panel that's in our office. So, you know, they can see the instantaneous wind speeds, the instantaneous power coming out of it, see the direction the wind turbine is pointed. They can count the number of times it turns in a day if you want to. I mean, there are hundreds of pieces of information that's available, you know, to the students to use. So,
you have students that are especially interested in wind turbine energy?
Since we've started this little bit of publicity on the wind turbine, yes, I have provided the access information to a number of mostly groups on campus. I'm still trying to find my niche to get into the school systems, you know, the middle school, high school, even the grade schools, if they find they're using for it, to use it. You know, we'll gladly give them the access information. All they have to do is just contact us at ISU Utilities and give us an email address, and I have a four-page form that I can email to them, and instantly we'll get them onto the system. So,
does your university plan any expansion of the program or perhaps additional units?
I don't know that we'll do another unit because of the space constraints that, you know, we have on camp. We found about the one spot where we could put it that was easy to put it. You know, if we were to go anyplace else, we'd potentially put it in the floodplains that we have here, you know, on that side of campus, which we don't want to do that. About the only location I could think of that would be viable options would be maybe clear out on the northwest side of campus. And again, you know, we don't have a good electrical system out there because there's no buildings out there, so it'd be expensive to tie it back into the system. So,
So Randy, before you go, what do you actually do in maintaining it or operating it, or what's your...
Well, mostly all we're doing is just monitoring what's going on with it. I mean, you know, the manufacturer of the wind turbine also sees all the information on it. If they detect a problem because of all the diagnostic hardware that's built into this thing, they can remotely control it from their site, which is out in Maine. So,
oh wow.
Vermont. I get my states right. It's out there in the northeast. Mm-hmm. So they can control.
Yeah, well, they feel that way about Iowa too.
I'm sure they do.
Bunch of retards.
Yeah, but so they monitor it, and and then the company we bought it from is responsible for coming in doing all the maintenance. And their crews were actually just here a couple of weeks ago and did the annual maintenance on it, where they did all the lubrications and the checkouts and made sure everything was good to operate, for another year. So from our standpoint, it's pretty much just stand back and watch it and monitor it, and if we see a problem with it, we have the ability to turn it off and isolate it from the grid if we need to. But other than that, it's pretty much just enjoy the power we can get off of it. And obviously, we pay for it. You know, we get billed every month for the energy, just like the city of Ames would bill you as a homeowner for the energy you use. Well, they're generating electricity, and we send them a check every month.
Any last words before you go?
I'll leave a little information. If you guys have got a website, you want to put the link to this
Absolutely.
On your website, I'll leave you a little information for that, because, like I said, I'm looking for anybody that wants access to study this, because there's a lot of good things that you could do with this in a classroom environment. You know, this wind turbine ties directly to weather. There's a lot of research you can do on wind turbines that's throughout the country. I mean, there's megawatts and megawatts and megawatts of wind turbines, especially in the Midwest. I mean, Iowa's got well over 3,000 megawatts of wind turbines in the state alone. So it's a growing industry. It's here to stay. It's not going to go away. The more we can educate everybody about what these things can do and can't do, then they all understand what's going on. So that's really what we're trying to do with this, is give the classrooms an opportunity to learn more about wind turbines.
Randy Larrabee, Assistant Director of Utilities at ISU, thanks again for coming in.
And we'll leave information to contact you on our website at khoifm.org.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
To every purpose under heaven. Everything turns, there is a season turn, and a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to build up, a time to break down, a time to dance, a time to mourn, a time to cast away stones, a time to gather stones.
This is Local Talk on KHOI, Community Radio 89.1, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, James Winters, together with my co-host, Ursula Rudenberg and Rebecca Brown. We've been talking with Randy Larrabee, Assistant Director of Utilities at Iowa State University. He's been telling us about the various ways ISU is getting wind power to supply the electrical needs of the campus. We're taking some time today to explore a few ways that we're using wind power here in Iowa.
Donald Kamm, Director of Electrical Services for the City of Ames, has joined us by telephone, and we wanted to ask him if wind supplies energy for the City of Ames. Hi, Donald. Are you with us?
Good morning. Yes, I am.
Good morning. We're so glad that you're able to speak with us this morning. We talked to you about Ames Power before here on KHOI, but I think that was more about coal and the recycling plant, and now we'd like to talk to you about wind energy. So how much of our power in Ames is generated from wind?
Well, if you look at how much energy that the wind farm that we have under contract produces, it works out to about 15% of the energy that the residents in Ames uses.
Ames is a municipal utility, and we own our own power plant, but it sounds like we don't own wind turbines. Is that correct?
That's correct. Several years ago, the City Council, we looked at either building a wind farm north of Boone with a group of other municipals, and at the same time to make sure that we were looking at the best possible resource for the city, we also sent out what's called a request for proposal. And through that, there were several wind developers that bid into that, and the winning company was a company called NextEra that was building a wind farm near Ziering and Colo. And so we ended up signing a long-term contract with them to buy the output off of a farm located there.
So this is when you drive up Highway 35, you start to see a lot of wind turbines as you go higher up in the county. Is that correct?
Correct. If you look off to your right as you're heading north, mm-hmm. You'll start seeing wind turbines in the distance. And we have under contract 24 wind turbines.
So
there's actually two what we call wind farms there, each of which have 100 turbines each, all built by NextEra. And the portion that we own, Google happens to be the user of the remaining wind turbines up there.
Hmm. So who is NextEra?
NextEra is an investor-owned utility. They're based out of Florida. They've really specialized in building wind farms up in the upper Midwest. Ours is called Story County 2 or Garden Wind, and they own other wind farms throughout the state. In fact, even into Minnesota.
Now, a wind farm is a relatively new term. It's not a term that I grew up with. And the turbines, are they sitting on land that is being leased from a farmer, or does NextEra own this land?
Typically, it's land leased from a farmer.
I wonder if you could talk about the cost of wind power. I'm assuming it's broken down, you know, the cost per kilowatt hour or kilowatt. Could you talk about that?
Correct. The two terms you brought up, kilowatt hour is a measure of the energy that is used off of a wind farm. Kilowatts is the physical or the electrical capability to produce a certain amount of energy, you know, when you have enough wind, the way our contracts are set up. And I need to point out, too, that the wind farm that we've signed a contract, we have 24 turbines. That's the equivalent of 36 megawatts of capability, another electrical term. And of those 36 megawatts, six of those megawatts are actually used by Iowa State. So I know you had Randy Larrabee on earlier. They actually are a partial off-taker from that wind farm. The way our contract with them is set up is NextEra paid the capital cost of installing the wind, and then we buy the offtake. We buy the production of the wind farm and pay on a per kilowatt hour basis.
What is the major drawback, or what is the main challenge involved with the generation of wind power, would you say?
Yeah, very good question. There are drawbacks with virtually any kind of generation that you're looking at. In the case of wind, typically it's windy when you need it the least. If you have the early morning hours where it's windy on any given day, that's typically when the electric demand on the system is down. So you get this large amount of low-cost, environmentally friendly wind, but there's not a lot of load to use it. Typically, utilities in the upper Midwest need it the most in the hot, dry, calm summer days when air conditioners are running, and there's typically not a lot of wind being produced.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say that wind still is not a valuable component of a generation mix. The second piece that kind of ties into that, and we feel it a little bit in our area, is wind is concentrated in local spots. I mentioned that there are two wind farms in Ziering and Colo, each of 100 turbines, which produces in grand total 300 megawatts if the wind is right. 300 megawatts located in such a small location, you need a lot of transmission. You need a lot of wires coming from there and then delivering it to Ames and other load centers. And that sometimes becomes a bottleneck because there may not be enough transmission built to move that wind energy to places where it can be best used.
This is a layman's question, but it's something I've always wondered. Is the energy actually stored at the site of the turbine, or is it immediately transferred to wherever it's being used?
Yeah, electricity today, it's not convenient to store it anywhere. So it's the moment it's produced is the moment it's being used. So that's another uniqueness within the electrical grid, is any energy as it's produced is immediately used. So you must match the load, or you must match the generation with the load that's being used, and it has to be on a constant instantaneous basis. So in the case of a wind turbine, if the wind dies down, you must ramp up other generation immediately to cover that load, or you could have system-wide brownouts, blackouts, and more problems on the grid.
How is the electricity actually delivered?
For us, that's kind of an interesting, I don't know if I can best describe it, but it's kind of like a bucket of water. So as you pour water into one side of the bucket and take it out to the other side, we're not physically getting the electrons that are being produced by the wind turbine into Ames. So the wind farms and all generation within the region produce energy and they put it onto the grid, and then us and other utilities, Mid-American, Story City, and other utilities around the area, then use that energy off the grid. So it's the best analogy I can come up with is a bucket of water that generation is being poured in and customers are taking it out.
So the farm patched into the grid in such a way that on low demand periods and high generation periods, can we, you know, push that electromotive force upstream into the grid and to be used in other markets?
The electricity is much like a spider web. So as energy gets onto the grid, it goes all over. I think what you're maybe suggesting is there a different way to store energy, whether it's wind or any other kind? And I know there have been projects talked about in years past where could you use wind maybe to pump water up a hill, and then when you need the energy, have that water in essence flow down a hill, turn a turbine, and then kind of store that kinetic energy, store that the ability to produce electricity. Other projects that have been talked about is use wind and pump air into caverns under the earth, and then with that pressure, could you bring that up and run generation with that at a later date? Those are concepts that are talked about. I have not seen any myself that have gone into practice. So the capability is there, but the right project has not been created to my knowledge in the area that would allow that to happen.
So we're speaking with Donald Kamm, who's the Director of Electrical Services for the City of Ames Utilities, and about how Ames is using wind power to supplement its utilities. Donald, tell us again about how much of the Ames utility is being supplied by wind?
If you look at our overall energy use, about 15% of our energy is being produced out at the wind farm.
Okay, thank you. Any last words?
I happen to be up here in Minnesota, and trust me, I'm tired of snow.
Well, we got snow down here too, so come on home and enjoy the snow in Ames, Iowa. And thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Donald.
Bye-bye.
All right, thank you all very much.
Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, one of your hosts, and I'm here with Rebecca Brown and James Winters. We've been talking about wind power at Iowa State and in Ames, but here's another story about windmills for private use on a much smaller scale. Mark Rehnquist has a small farm, and he uses wind power to run his farm. Hi, Mark. Are you there?
Yes, good morning.
Hi. Mark, where are you located?
So we're in rural southwest Marshall County, about 12 miles southwest of Marshalltown.
And you're on a farm, is that correct?
Yeah, we have a small 7-acre diversified farm.
What do you farm?
We farm farmers market, flowers, fruits, strawberries, vegetables, whole range of things.
So you have a windmill on your farm, is that correct?
Yes, we have a 2.4 kilowatt SkyStream turbine. It's on a 100-foot tower, and we enjoy it very much.
So tell us about this. How did this all get started?
The primary reason was, you know, we're kind of looking at our farm and the way we impact the earth, and we were very keen on sustainability. So we had kind of worked on sustainability in terms of our own food for our family, but energy was a big place where we were lacking. So we started looking at options to kind of be able to produce our own power. And we started on wind at the time because at the time wind power was so much cheaper than solar. We looked at a number of different turbine types and eventually settled on the SkyStream.
Now, with the SkyStream, did you purchase it outright? And is there, or do you lease it? Or is there some kind of arrangement that you have with the manufacturer, you know, for service? Because, you know, it has moving parts and nothing is going to just turn forever, after all. What's the financial consideration of your, you know,
right,
initial investment?
We just purchased outright after the 30% federal tax credit that cost about $10,000, and there's virtually no maintenance, regular scheduled maintenance on the turbine. It's been up for 5 years. Our installer tells us there are certain things that are starting to wear out that he anticipates we'll need to fix, but that hasn't happened yet. It's actually a UL-listed appliance.
So what do you use the wind turbine for, Mark? Mark's gone.
Oh.
We're going to have to try and get Mark back some other time.
You ask hard questions, Ursula.
Scared him away.
He was like, I can't deal with this.
Well, I for one thought Mark was really interesting, so we'll get him back on another local talk show.
I had more questions.
We plan to do a few more shows on wind anyway, so we'll get him back.
Thank you, Mark, if you're listening, and call us back, and we'll talk to you soon. Anyway, you're on KHOI. 89.1 FM, Heart of Iowa.
Turn, turn, turn. I've got time to.
to everything. Turn, turn, turn. There is a season. Turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to build up. A time to break down. A time to dance. A time to mourn. A time to cast away stones. A time to gather stones together.
Hello, friends. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. In the last part of the hour, I bring you another interview about Iowans and travel. Iowans who've been affected with the wanderlust, so to speak. So today I have Tammy and Chris Martin. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So first of all, why don't you guys introduce yourselves to the community and what your role is in the community?
Okay. I'm Tammy Martin, and currently I work for the Midwest Grape and Wine Industry Institute on the Iowa State University campus. A lot of your listeners might know me as former manager of Worldly Goods, where I spent about 5 years.
And Chris?
I'm Chris Martin, and I actually teach in the College of Design. I teach furniture design there, and actually had Becca as a student a couple years ago.
Well, certainly fun. So, Tammy, could you describe what Peace Corps is to maybe folks who don't know what it is?
Sure. The United States Peace Corps is a volunteer organization where people are able to volunteer their time and talents as long as they have a 27-month time period to do it.
So whose idea was it to join Peace Corps?
Well, actually, it was probably started with Tammy. So it goes a ways back. We actually met in undergrad school. We both went to undergrad school here at Iowa State. And we met Tammy's last semester of school. And she was actually planning on doing Peace Corps when she graduated, which is kind of the common practice. Students come out of undergrad school, and that's a majority of Peace Corps volunteers are at that age. And I showed up and threw a wrench in the works. So she postponed the idea.
He did. He really threw the whole thing off. And going back to my time at Worldly Goods, there was one day when I was working in the store and a woman came in, and I explained how I kind of looked at that position as my Peace Corps job and gave her the background of how I had always wanted to do Peace Corps. But, you know, plans change. And at that point, I said, well, I'm going to wait until the time I retire, because at that point I will have gained a lot more experience and I'll have a lot more to offer the people that I'm serving. And she stopped me in my tracks and she put her hands on my shoulder and looked me in the eye and she said, "You need to do Peace Corps right now and you will have that much more to offer for the rest of your life." And I said,
All right, so you were convinced to do Peace Corps now. And so where did you go?
I'll try to nutshell this. I had become tenured, and I started thinking about what I would do for a professional development assignment at the university. And we were talking over dinner one night, and Tammy suggested that maybe we try Peace Corps. So talked to my department head. They were supportive. The college was supportive. So we applied for Peace Corps. Went through the process. It took over a year to do the application process because of extenuating circumstances, timelines. And we were told that we would be going to sub-Saharan Africa. And then a couple months before our assignment, we found out we were going to Ghana.
And as I recall, you weren't too enthusiastic about it.
I actually, one of the things that they do in the interview processes, which is a major part of the application process, is they ask you where you would like to go if you had your preference. You're not guaranteed that you'll get to go where you want, but my preference was Eastern Europe or one of the stands. And actually, Tammy's was Africa.
Although I never during the application or interview process did I ever state that I had a preference. But in the back of my mind, I was thinking, wow, Africa would be cool.
And I, you know, to be quite honest, had this impression of Africa, which I think, unfortunately, so many Americans have of, you know, this the idea that, CAR, Central African Republic, and kind of the situation they're in right now. That was kind of my honestly my image of Africa.
And how did it feel to leave your job, especially this late in life?
For me, it was Tammy had done this position at Worldly Goods, and I was profoundly in awe of her and what she was doing. And I kept saying, "I want to do something bigger. I want to do something bigger." So, you know, that's the Peace Corps thing came up, and I quite honestly was, at the same time that I was apprehensive, I was really excited about that. And part of a professional development assignment is to rejuvenate yourself, regain a passion, maybe that you'd been fostering for a while. So it was weird leaving the United States. It was strange leaving a career, but knowing that I'd be back in 2 years was kind of that light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, but you're right, Becca, in that people in their mid-career do not typically undertake something like a 27-month volunteer commitment for Peace Corps. So it was a little bit unusual. And one of the stipulations for being a Peace Corps volunteer is that they don't allow you to do it if you have dependents. And so we are also in a unique situation where we do not have any dependents.
Chris, you mentioned that you do furniture design.
Mm-hmm.
So how did this trip influence your artwork?
Profoundly. Before I went, I was my common statement with that is before I left for Peace Corps, I was doing my work was very designerly. Personally, I think well-built, well-designed work with not a lot of narrative. When I got back, actually, I got a Iowa Arts Council grant to develop a body of work based on my experiences in Ghana. And every piece now that I'm doing is narrative. Basically, all the work I'm doing is inspired by my experiences there and inspired by the country and the people there.
Tammy, how about yourself?
Well, I was going to actually expand on Chris's work. And his work does have a lot more meaning behind it now than what it used to, although his work has always been fantastic. The other thing is that he didn't mention, but he will be having a show of his work at the Octagon this fall. So if people are interested in seeing the influence it has and how an artist brings furniture and inspiration and narrative together, they'll be able to see it there.
How was it to do it as a couple? Some people typically do Peace Corps by themselves, but
yeah, and it was really kind of funny because when we were in Peace Corps, it was always the single volunteers were always saying that they were in awe of us and how we could do this as a couple, and it was kind of the reverse with them. I was in awe that a single person could do it. You know, when you're in Peace Corps, we're in a small village in the middle of nowhere, basically, and you're together 24/7 for 27 months, and it's a test. It is a real test of your relationship. I think we tested well. I thought
We did. We're back.
We're still together.
We're still married, and I have to say that's not true for other couples that were married at the same time.
Yeah, we actually had two couples. The people who replaced us joined Peace Corps, and they're a reasonably young couple, but the couple that joined us or replaced us joined Peace Corps and then got divorced right after they got back. And then there was another couple that was with us during our training, and he actually left during training, and she stayed on for about 6 months and then dropped
out. People should go to you for relationship advice.
Hardly.
Any advice to the community about taking that, because that's a pretty big leap.
It is.
It's pretty courageous. So do you have any advice for the rest of Story County? For maybe not necessarily joining Peace Corps, but, you know.
There are volunteer opportunities in your own backyard.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're even considering doing something, you might start there. Your own community has a lot of opportunities for you. And if you catch the bug, I would really encourage people to consider Peace Corps or something bigger, because you can do it. You know, people look at us and they say, I can't. Well, no, they don't say, I can't believe you did it. But but they say, I don't think I could do something like that. But people are extremely adaptive, and you can. You can do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you describe a little bit more what you actually did while you were in Ghana?
Really, to go through the process, basically you go to country. You go into the country, you spend 3 months, you live with a family there for 3 months, and you do culture training and language training. And then we were teachers at a high school in a rural village. So Tammy taught ICT, which is computer literacy, which was kind of funny.
Yeah, teaching computer literacy to a class of 30 when you have just a few computers that sometimes work if there's electricity.
Yeah, in the early 90s vintage computers.
It's quite interesting. So a lot of the teaching for computer literacy for me in my class happened on the chalkboard.
Yeah, and then I taught visual arts at the school. And, you know, so that was our primary assignment. And then we could do secondary projects if we wanted to. And that's, to be honest, I personally found my fulfillment in secondary projects. We had clubs at the school. We had an English club. We taught in English, but a majority of the students in the villages that came from the bush, so came from the very, very small villages outside of the village we were in, spoke very little English. So we had a club for that. I did this Satchet Wallet project with my students. So we were doing product design, dealing with plastic waste in country, which I continue to work on today.
And then I also worked with formed a neighborhood women's organization,
right,
where we would just sit down and talk and come up with issues that were important to them. And through that, we did some things like brought in some people from the hospital to talk about family planning issues, microfinance, and things like that.
Would you do it again?
Absolutely.
Yes,
and we plan on doing it again.
Oh,
yeah. Would we go back to the same country? I went back to Ghana last summer, mm-hmm, planning on going this summer, but I decided I have too much other things to do. So the plan is to take actually students back next summer, and Tammy and I will lead a group of students from the university, go over to Ghana and work on some service learning projects and also do workshops with traditional craftsmen. But as far as Peace Corps, we'll definitely do it again, but would like to be assigned to a different country just so we can experience other countries.
Right.
Yeah, we'll maintain our ties with Ghana.
Yeah,
we
absolutely
can do that now, and we'll look forward to having another incredible once-in-a-lifetime experience for the second time.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. It was really nice to hear, and I'm sure the rest of the community appreciated it.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Becca.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and today we've been talking about wind turbines and then reflections from Peace Corps volunteers in Ghana, Chris and Tammy Martin. Thank you for coming in, Chris and Tammy.
All right. Our guests today have been James Winters. Our guests today have been Susan Franson, Randy Larrabee, Donald Combe, Mark Rundquist, and of course, Tammy and Chris Martin. Your hosts today have been Ursula Rudenberg and Rebecca Brown, myself, James Winters. Local Talk is engineered by Rebecca Brown, of course, and our music has been Turn, Turn, Turn by the Birds. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
You can listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online on our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org, where you will find an archive for all of the Local Talk shows we've produced since we've been on the air in 2012. You can find that on our website. Recent shows will be posted on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, can get the information. There you can find lists of our guests and links to the organizations and other resources mentioned on our shows.
If you've enjoyed this show, tell your friends and consider becoming one of the 500 families or individuals who donate $20 per month or $250 per year to help us meet our operating expenses, though we appreciate whatever fits your budget. We'd like to get your feedback, if you have some, either by phone, 292-2878, it's 292-2878, or by email at khoiradio@gmail.com. Please mark your calendars. On April 19th, KHOI will hold a grand opening for our brand new studios. These studios are all volunteer built, and I am not exaggerating when I say they are gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
We want to show them off to you. Why do we volunteer our time to build and run KHOI?
Mm.
We do it because we love our community.
Yeah.
So please come and help us celebrate this achievement of our community. That's April 19th, 6 p.m. at 410 Douglas Avenue in Ames. Bring your friends and introduce them to community radio.
I'm pretty sure refreshments will be served at some point as well. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you'd like to join the team as a reporter or maybe you'd like to just help us clean up around here or produce shows, contact us at 292-2878 or at the email khoiradio@gmail.com. Your participation as audience makes KHOI possible. So thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.